In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
Welcome to the Voice of Russia and its weekend program, The Red Line. Every weekend, we, Sergei Strokin, Mira Salganik, and Yekaterina Kudashkina, invite you to discuss the most significant events of the week. We are joined by Russian and international experts, politicians, scientists and artists, sharing or opposing our views on the vast and increasingly interdependent world shared by all of us.
We want our program to be personal, provocative and fair.
So this week, we will continue to watch the situation in Pakistan. News of another terrorist attack in Pakistan, in which about 70 people were killed, hit the news wires. Then, the Abbottabad raid in which Osama bin Laden was killed delivered a new blow to relations between the US and Pakistan, two key allies in the global war on terror. So we shall try to look into what could be the outcome of the recent turbulence in that country. We shall then move on to the Middle East to discuss the implications of the recent historic reconciliation between Palestinian warring factions to find out what are the chances for the new independent Palestinian state. And finally, we will discuss an Austrian judge ruling that former Croatian Premier Ivo Sanader may be extradited to his home country on corruption charges.
Katya, incidentally, this new terrorist attack and the new chill in US-Pakistani relations coincided with President Zardari's visit to Russia. This is the first official visit which has already been called by regional press as Indian summer for Zardari. So, too many events and very much interrelated.
Oh, yes. These days are very rich in events for Pakistan. But talking about Indian summer, you know, from across the Atlantic, I'd say harsh winter winds are reaching all the way to Islamabad. Let's get started. Beyond the headlines, this is the opening chapter of our weekly program, in which this time we'll discuss the recent developments in Pakistan. First, the blast. A suicide bomber on a motorcycle killed at least 69 people at a paramilitary force academy in northwest Pakistan on Friday, in what Pakistani Taliban militants said was retaliation for the US raid that killed Osama bin Laden in the country. And now look what the first wire report suggests. Just let me quote. According to Reuters, the first major bombing in Pakistan since bin Laden's death on the 2nd of May, it will reinforce fears of retaliation by Al-Qaeda and allied groups like the Pakistani Taliban scattered around the world and loosely connected by ideology. To me, it really looks like a very grim forecast. Do you agree?
But we could have expected this.
We could have expected what?
I mean this retaliation, because shortly after bin Laden killing, they said that they would respond in a very strong way.
But I also thought that you were telling me that, of course, this is not an isolated case of attacks targeting Pakistani military compounds and Pakistani security services. Am I correct?
Definitely, this is a challenge and they would have to look into it.
Now, I suggest that we could talk to our guest speaker, who is Ambassador Gopalaswamy Parthasarathy. He's professor in international security in the Center for Policy Research in New Delhi, India, and he's a very experienced Indian diplomat.
The attack which killed 69 members of the Pakistani paramilitary frontier force near Charsada and the capital Peshawar today is quite evidently the work of a group called the Tehreek-e-Taliban in Pakistan, or the Taliban Movement of Pakistan. Now, the Taliban Movement of Pakistan was really a group which was backed both by Pakistan's military and the intelligence services till 2007. They are allies of the Afghan Taliban and have worked together with the Afghan Taliban against American and other forces in Afghanistan. They turned against the Pakistan government in 2007 after the Pakistan military attacked a mosque in the capital Islamabad. The mosque was called the Red Mosque. And in that attack, several tribal women were killed. They were studying in the madrasa near the mosque. And this group thereafter turned against the Pakistan military. So this is a group which is allied with similar groups. They belong to the Deobandi Muslim sect. They have turned against the Pakistan military, but at the same time, they support the Afghan Taliban, which the Pakistan military and intelligence is continuing to do.
Could that also be partly a retaliation against the assassination of bin Laden?
That the bin Laden killing certainly has sort of strengthened the anti-American sentiments, the anti-establishment sentiments of those who believe the establishment supports the Americans. But this sort of attack has been taking place somewhat regularly, particularly in the Northwest Frontier Province. But this is certainly the largest attack where the maximum number of people have died.
Do I get you right that the scope of the attack implies that it has been planned long beforehand, before the killing of Osama bin Laden?
One can't say when exactly it was planned, but certainly such attacks or consistent attacks on Pakistan's security establishment have been taking place ever since 2007.
And do I get to try that that series of attacks, including the recent developments, actually deliver a powerful blow on the Pakistani security services? Is my understanding
correct? Well, the Pakistan security services are unfortunately now fighting groups they were once supporting.
But that's an ordinary
story.
Groups.
That's a common story, yes.
So what is your forecast? Do you think that the present civilian government is going to stand out in the face of these attacks? Is it going to survive?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the persons who have been most discredited in the eyes of the people of Pakistan is the Pakistani military. Mm-hmm. Because bin Laden was found and attacked by the Americans in the heart of a military cantonment next to the largest military officers' military training academy in Pakistan, which is a very prestigious academy. So if the most wanted terrorist is found to be living next to a military establishment where thousands of officers are trained, it's a disgrace to the military. So I don't think the civilian government has suffered. The maximum loss of prestige in Pakistan has been suffered by the Pakistan military.
And now to bin Laden's assassination. I believe that the Pakistani military shall really have to face the consequences of the U.S. Navy SEALs raid on bin Laden's hideout in Abbottabad. Its outcome actually becomes a little bit more outlined as the dust settles. And in fact, the American Special Forces raid, hailed as President Obama's biggest victory in his war on terror, is also perceived as a serious embarrassment, if not humiliation, to Pakistan's powerful military establishment too.
Katya, that was really humiliation. And not surprisingly, Obama's triumph prompted Pakistani leaders to make unusually harsh gestures.
Well, there is a lot of face-saving rhetoric coming from Pakistan leadership, yet there is some truth in the statement of Pakistani Prime Minister Yusuf Reza Gilani when he says, unilateralism runs the inherent risk of serious consequences. Meantime, please note that Pakistani opposition is rocking the boat, calling for government's immediate resignation and an early election.
Mira, but some demanded because the government allowed such a breach of Pakistani sovereignty as American raid on Osama bin Laden's hideout, while the other find it guilty for letting Osama comfortably hide for years in their country, or else considering that they knew it.
In fact, Prime Minister Gilani went even further, insisting that Pakistan reserves the right to retaliate with full force. Although he stopped short of spelling what specifically would be done, provided the U.S. staged another unilateral, high-profile anti-terror raid on Pakistani territory. But to me, it actually looks more like an emotional reaction.
Well, Katya, for me, that sounds confusing. It's not quite clear what they mean when they say retaliate with full force.
No. Sergei, I think it's really more emotional. I think that as, like you say, the dust settles, emotions would be running lower.
Anyway, we can't expect, of course, Pakistan to attack the U.S. targets.
But it's been a very old friendship, by the way.
So this formula, retaliate with full force, sounds crazy to me. But at any rate, this threat is by no means a sign of healthy ties between the two states.
But, you know, the Pakistani military on their part have demanded that the United States cut its troop presence in the country to a minimum, and they also threatened to review the bilateral cooperation.
This is a serious sign also.
But look, Sergei, both U.S. and Pakistan need their alliance. The U.S. needs Pakistan as a key ally in the war on terror. Is that correct?
That's right.
And the region, in a very turbulent region.
And Pakistan also needs the alliance with the United States, of course, to reinforce its position in the region. It's also useful for its dialogue with India.
Yeah, that sort of squabbling partners.
Yes, of course.
Precisely.
So we all know that the U.S.-Pakistani relations have gone through many crises in recent years. Well, this time it looks particularly painful, but the pain usually goes.
Well, I guess that it's particularly painful because it is so absolutely public. There is a lot of attention because of bin Laden and things. I think we should try to answer the question of what went wrong in the relations between the two allies and when. There is no question that the liquidation of Osama bin Laden was the only way to terminate the activities of Al-Qaeda's sinister leader once and for all. However, I guess the circumstances of the raid show that it had nothing to do with the much advertised bilateral and multilateral cooperation in fighting terrorism.
Mira, I think you have a point. The refusal of the Obama administration not only to cooperate with Pakistan, but even to inform Islamabad on that operation, to me, it's like a striking demonstration of a lack of trust despite all the ritual pledges to forge strategic alliance between the two.
Sergei, but you're not saying that now the Pakistani government believes it is not taken seriously by Washington, are you?
Well, this is where today's widening crack in the global war on terror alliance forged by President Bush and President Musharraf shortly after September 11 comes from. And let me just a bit elaborate on that. In fact, the crack didn't come overnight. And we know that Pakistan's sovereignty was neglected by U.S. continuous drone aircraft attacks on alleged terrorist targets in Pakistan's northwest frontier province. And that was obviously involving loss of life and civilians. And in addition to that, American side was disregarding protests of Pakistani authorities. And add to that, a recent scandal over Raymond Davis. You remember that story that U.S. consul
in Lahore?
Staff, yes, in Lahore, though he didn't have diplomatic immunity, but huge scandal.
Oh, yes, and we've discussed it before. Just let me remind our listeners of a few details of what happened in January. As Mr. Davis was driving through a crowded part of Lahore, which is the capital of Pakistan's most populous province of Punjab, he stopped at a cash machine and he got some money and he resumed his journey. But however, driving on, he soon noticed that he was being followed by a motorcycle. And according to Davis, the motorcycle rider and his passenger tried to hijack his vehicle at gunpoint. So all in all, the man took out his Glock gun and shot first.
So diplomat with sniper skills.
Diplomat with sniper skills and diplomat carrying a gun.
Yeah, that's right.
So the scene which followed is not that difficult to picture. Three dead Pakistanis and an American surrounded by infuriated crowd.
And it created an incredible uproar with massive demonstrations, anti-American sloganeering, prolonged and complicated diplomatic tug-of-war, and what have you. Then, as it is rumored, some money changed hands and Raymond Davis was released from Pakistani jail. He was sent home. Anti-American sentiment stayed on, adding to already existing deposits of it.
Mira, just as a follow-up to what you say, I have been to Pakistan and I have observed the anti-American sentiments, which is very strong, and common people not concerned with things like strategic relations between Pakistan and the United States or massive American aid to Pakistan. So these people are ready to blame anything on America, even Pakistan's swooning economy.
Sergei, tell me, is that a recent development or has it been there for quite a while already? I mean, the anti-American
this
sentiment.
This is quite a long process. They didn't start overnight.
Of course, but did it start with the onset of the global war on terror of Pakistan's engagement?
I think the turning point was definitely that big gamble, big deal, which was made by President Musharraf.
Which means that it wasn't there before the U.S. started their operation in Afghanistan. Am I correct?
No, it was, but on a lesser scale.
From my point of view, definitely it is related to the aftermath of September 11 and to that big gamble which was made by President Musharraf. And in fact, in his book, which is very personal, with unusual frankness, President Musharraf describing how difficult for him was just to make this deal, that he was under immense pressure. He understood that it would backlash, but there was no option.
Yes, I think that was just an offer which he could not decline. Because we all remember how long he was taking this decision.
So it backlashed.
It backlashed.
Well, and moreover, the country is gripped by mounting domestic troubles, internal strife, and faltering economy, and many other things. The corruption is truly indescribable. The government, obviously unable to cope with it, seems to hobble from one political crisis to another against the background of economic misery and popular discontent. The last summer devastating flood, incidentally, I would like to say that there was the time, if you all remember, the massive humanitarian aid was pouring into Pakistan.
And it was.
Well, it was mishandled.
It was mishandled from the very recent reports that I have seen just overnight, I might say. very little has come to the people who needed the support.
This which is a shame, really.
Which is a shame, but that just demonstrates the
level,
the level of corruption. That's what I was meaning to say.
That's a very good observation.
Mira, well, at that background, the background of these developments, American policy towards cash-strapped, utterly corrupted Pakistan, involving huge multi-million aid package, can be bluntly described as aid for raid program. This is how I see it. So, from my point of view, it is based on the understanding shared by American establishment that there is no way for Pakistan to abandon the donor who pays and sets the rules of the game, obviously. So, the Pakistani leadership knows it too. Never mind the face-saving rhetoric.
And which is really somewhat of a humiliating situation for the Pakistani establishment.
For Pakistani military also.
For Pakistani military. By the way, do you remember that a couple of years ago there was a very interesting book published which was focusing on business interests of the Pakistani military? And they also maintained that the military in Pakistan are really an empire.
It's not very difficult to build an empire on huge of American aid.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good
one,
Mira.
That's a true one.
But anyway, we can understand some exasperation on the American part when they accuse the Pakistani military that they're dragging their feet in the war on terror and they're mishandling the money of U.S. taxpayers.
Yes, I agree with that, but now let us see how it is related to President Zardari's visit to Moscow. This is his first official visit to Russia.
Well, it is reported that the sides would emphasize the importance both of them attach to cooperating closely on issues of stability, peace and security in the common region.
Mira, the last thing I want is to say that Russian-Pakistani newly developing bonds should be built at the expense of a third party, be it United States or some other party. But there's a growing wariness in the region on that aid for raid policy. And I was watching what was said President Zardari's talks in Kremlin with President Medvedev. And I have a feeling that major regional players show resolve to come together to decide how to build additional security mechanisms. So this is not against America, you see. This is not against American-Pakistani alliance. But it should be supplemented by additional security mechanisms. Shanghai Six, through Russian, Chinese, Indian cooperation. There was a lot of talk about this triangle, you know.
So, look, do I get you right that the future of the present civilian Pakistani government largely depends on the support it gains from its various international partners and from its international partnership?
That's right, because Pakistani government, Pakistani authorities, for a very long time were putting too many eggs in one basket. This is my point.
And now I'm happy to introduce our guest, Vyacheslav Belokrinitsky, Deputy Director at the Institute of Oriental Studies of the Russian Academy of Sciences. Mr. Belokrinitsky, thank you very much for joining us. And my basic question is, of course, about the visit of Mr. Zardari to Russia. So what was the major objective of this visit?
The major objective of the visit is to discuss the bilateral relations, first of all. Because officially, the agenda of this visit, it is one of the rare occasions in the relationship between Russia and Pakistan. The last visit of the first person in the ruling hierarchy of Pakistan, the last time it was the visit of President Pervez Musharraf in February 2003. Many years have passed since the visit, but of course we can also underline that this is the fifth meeting of President Medvedev and President Zardari, as they met each other at the conferences, the multilateral conferences held in Russia, in Yekaterinburg, in Sochi. Last time they met in August 2010 in Sochi, where both presidents participated in the meeting with the president of Afghanistan. Therefore, the relationship between the two countries are developing rather fast. Recently, there seemed to be a real breakthrough in the relationship between Russia and Pakistan due to certain circumstances and causes. I would say that the major reason is change of regional situation. Russia's growing concern about the situation in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, just as the situation in Afghanistan is very much linked to Pakistan's situation. And in general, the geopolitical situation in the region is really in the focus of Moscow's attention, and this is why Moscow pays so much attention to the relations with Pakistan these days. One of the major issues that will be discussed, of course, is the situation in Afghanistan in two aspects. First of all, the situation in the field of drug trafficking. Afghanistan's situation is a great concern for Russia because of the drug problem and of the Islamic radical movement. And this is also disturbing, the center of this problem. And so it is much concern to Russia. So this is one aspect of the relationship that we shall underline. And then, of course, some bilateral relations there exist. Potential of developing economic relations, of growing the trade relations and economic cooperation between the two countries. Among these problems that can be solved in the course of developing of bilateral relations, we can mention the cooperation in the energy sector, in agriculture, and even the very long-standing question of expanding the Pakistan steel mill that was built by the USSR, with the help of the USSR. In the 70s, 80s. It also may come up in the talks between the two presidents. And in general, the trade level is still and all very, very modest for the two countries that are quite big enough and have good potentials. Now it is less than $400 million. The last year trade figures are only less than $400 million. This is really a meager sum, very negligible. Therefore, there is a potential of growth in the straight field. And once again, I would stress the importance of the regional cooperation. Russia is interested in promoting this regional cooperation between the Central Asian countries, first of all, between Tajikistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan. And, of course, there were several meetings and summit meetings of these three countries, four countries, actually. So there are bilateral formats of relationship, and there's multilateral forms of relationship. And strategic relationship is now, the importance of this strategic relationship is growing. Once again, just summarize. The issue of Afghanistan in the context of future development there. There is a great concern in Moscow. What comes after the United States would probably leave the country after some time, by 2014 or later, a bit later than that date, then what will be the situation in the region? How it will affect the drug problem, the Islamist terrorist problem? And this is a great concern for the security of Central Asia. And as Russia considers Central Asia as a territory of its big concern, and therefore Russia takes interest in what would come next. I say the presidents of two countries will probably discuss the issue of whether and when the United States and the coalition that is now there in Afghanistan, where they effectively live the country, and on what terms, with what consequences. And this is also quite an important issue to discuss. And then the bilateral relations, of course, will come into the focus.
I was actually thinking that Mr. Zardari's visit is coming in a very sensitive moment for Pakistan, judging the assassination of Osama bin Laden. So what could be the repercussions of this action, both for Pakistani establishment, just how consolidated is the establishment on this issue, for Pakistan's relations with the United States and with China? So could you expand a little bit on that?
Yes, right. You're quite correct in mentioning that this visit is one of the first visits by the president of Pakistan, foreign visits, after bin Laden's assassination on the 2nd of May. His visit to Russia was planned before, well before, and the official announcement about his going to Moscow for a four-day visit was announced in Pakistan on the 30th of April, 2 days before the assassination. Therefore, they are not interconnected, these events. But Russia sticks to these plans of inviting the president of Pakistan. It's important for Pakistan, of course. It is a kind of exit in the context of very strained relationship between Islamabad and Washington. In this context, we can see this visit by President Zardari and then the announced visit by President Prime Minister Gilani, who is announced to go to Beijing, to China, from 17th of May for a four-day visit too. So for Pakistan, it's very important at this moment because the relationship between the military and intelligence services of two countries are very strained. They are probably at their lowest. They reached the lowest these days. And the Pakistan is searching for a counter play in this moment. Therefore, it is very important for Pakistan. For Russia, too, it is just to have an independent position. Of course, Russia is not against and actually welcomes the struggle against terrorism. And on this particular issue of bin Laden's assassination, that was a welcome development if and when the effect of this assassination would be detrimental to the terrorist movement throughout the world and in this region particularly. Therefore, Russia supports this struggle against terrorism, but at the same time, it doesn't want to ostracize or just to put Pakistan in a very difficult situation. As for Pakistan's internal situation, I would mention that the military has lost faith in this operation. And I think that the civil authorities, which are represented by the president and the prime minister, are now strengthening their position. And it is possible to forecast and foresee that this kind of civil government would stay and continue to function in Pakistan.
Mr. Bilek Krunitsky, thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
And just to remind you, this time our guest speaker was Vyacheslav Bilek Krunitsky, deputy director at the Institute of Oriental Studies of the Russian Academy of Sciences.
You're tuned to the Voice of Russia.
And now we're moving on to Red Line's second heading, Between the Lines, where we usually discuss what we believe to be a most notable publication of the week. And this time, we chose a story, Less of America Now for Palestinians, which is written by Rami Khoury for the Lebanese Daily Star newspaper. One of the reasons we've chosen it for our program is that it represents a Levant vision of the reconciliation agreement signed last week between two leading Palestinian movements, Fatah and Hamas. And another reason is that its author is a well-known journalist. He's a Palestinian, he's a U.S. citizen now living in Lebanon, Amman and Nazareth, where his father's family comes from. So he's got a very interesting vision.
Actually, Rami Khoury focuses his attention on the American-Israeli reaction to the deal, which he believes once again misses the point. So I wonder, what is the point and why it is missed?
Well, Rami Khoury says that the point is missed, just let me quote, mainly because there is no peace process with Israel, and Palestinian leaders are signaling that they have essentially stopped playing the game of Middle East diplomacy according to American-Israeli rules. And according to the paper, this time the Palestinian leaders wish to focus on the internal development and national unity needs of the Palestinian people they serve.
Well, national unity is a highly commendable thing, no doubt, but I fail to see how Hamas's refusal to recognize Israel's existence, let alone making peace with it, detracts from the Palestinian national unity. I can't see it. And Hamas foreign policy chief Mahmoud al-Zahar did say that their plan does not incorporate in negotiations with Israel or recognizing it. This being so, I wanted just to add one thing, Sergei. This being so, one has to agree with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he says that it looks like Palestinians want peace with Hamas and not with Israel.
Well, Mira, I'm afraid that now you're missing the point. And let us begin at the beginning. After 4 years of what can be called a civil war between Fatah and Hamas, the two organizations have signed a reconciliation agreement last week in Cairo. Now, an interim non-partisan government is to be formed to prepare Palestine for elections and, moreover, for accelerating the establishment of the independent state, which would be recognized by the United Nations.
Yet it seems that there are very serious hurdles that might undermine the very idea of the new state, right?
Indeed.
So the Palestinian leaders still refuse to recognize Israel's right to exist. And in addition to that, the condemnation of Osama bin Laden's liquidation just doesn't make Palestinian leaders particularly welcome to some members of the international community, But on the other hand, there's a huge support to the recognition of the Palestinian state, because as far as I know, there are more than 100 countries around the world which would vote for the Palestinian state if there were a vote in the United Nations.
On principle, yes, Palestinian state will be supported by many, but much would depend on the leadership of this country, which would spell the direction in which it's going to develop.
So why don't we, then the reconciliation, so to say, of Fatah and Hamas, might actually be seen as just a step in that direction.
I'd love to say it this way, but just look at what is going on. It's premature to even spell it now. That's what my feeling is.
Well, we should see.
Yes, indeed.
Katya, the referrals you were referring to are there, but the Daily Star accuses America and Israel of dealing with the Palestinians, how it puts it solely through the lens of Israeli security concerns and American domestic political fears of the pro-Israeli zealots in Washington. This is the quote.
But could you a little bit perhaps expand on how you understand this phrase?
Well, I think that the author is, from my point of view, he's preoccupied with anti-Americanism.
Well, I think he does have
But he doesn't understand Israeli concerns, because I don't understand what is the problem of recognizing Israel as a state. Why they adopt such a stubborn position?
Well, if you ask me,
I'm not pro-Israeli, but my logic is, so what is the point? If you are sincere, if you want to make peace, so one simple thing, you say that we are ready to recognize the state. You can't build negotiations on such a stubborn position
on negativism. Something you really failed to remember. This is the Middle East, and those people have long memories.
But this is Global Village also.
This is Global Village too.
Which can a little bit influence the memories. And what I would like to say, I mean, this is just my personal view, since they are so stubborn against the recognition of Israel, which really doesn't make sense, say yes and see what happens after. This is the thing. There is no denial of the fact that a strong pro-Israeli lobby does exist in Washington.
In Washington too, yes, of
yes,
course.
Yes, no doubt. But still, I don't think that it's really the only force that determines the United States policy in the Middle East. I mean, it couldn't.
Obviously.
Even
it's not the only force, well, but it's a considerable factor.
It's a considerable force, but it's not the only force.
Of course not.
Not at all. And including American stance on Israel too. It can't be decided by pro-Israeli force alone. Out of the question. And regarding the Fatah-Hamas reconciliation, the position of Hamas, which, as far as I know, is listed in Washington as international terrorist organization, would immediately make Americans see red.
Oh, yes, they could see red. But, you know, after all, then they shall need to recognize that Hamas won the election, won the democratic election in that country. Well, it was part of the democratic process. I just mean to say, my point is that the whole situation is extremely complicated.
Yes, it is.
And it's
and very vulnerable.
It is extremely vulnerable. And it also must be regarded, the reconciliation, it could be a sign of Palestinian society's drive for unification.
I agree, Carter. I agree. But because one thing again, how would it harm them if they have peace with Israel?
Perhaps there are certain conditions on which they wanted to establish peace with Israel.
Well, let me spell what I suspect.
After all, yes, okay.
Well, I think that now that Egypt has mediated the whole thing, which is an interesting thing, that's the first political move of the new, I mean, let it be interim, but the government of Egypt. I think that Hamas hopes to get Arab support. I mean, not in words. I mean, materially. So that they could sort of, you know, take a more arrogant stance. Yes.
Well, perhaps the money issue could also explain why not everyone looks forward to peace process.
That's it.
So the good old explanation, cynical as it
is. The classical, let it be
cynical. Classical as it is. Okay. But getting back to our story, so just a day before the ceremony of initiating the reconciliation agreement.
Well, I would like to tell you, I've just picked it up what Mahmoud Abbas said on commenting this agreement. He said, we are now closing forever the black page of split. Fine.
Okay. Well, so if we look at the Palestinians really have been split in two parts, I mean, the Gaza sector and the West Bank. So there was Fatah in the West Bank, there was Hamas in Gaza.
After the democratic election,
yeah. That's right.
That was not obviously the first black page. And let me remind you, Mira, that the previous national unity government fell apart in 2007 when 100 lives were lost in armed clashes between Fatah and Hamas. And as a result, Palestinian autonomy actually was split, with Hamas ruling the Gaza Strip and Fatah controlling the West Bank. And it was only this much, after, as you said, change of power in Egypt and the fall of President Mubarak, who was more on the side of Mahmoud Abbas, from my point of view,
that
the
new
the new military leaders of Egypt mediated, and so they, as a result, there was a first meeting of Hamas and Fatah leaders, and finally there was a negotiating process, and finally it led that present reconciliation.
Anyway, some analysts believe that Hamas, with its rather young and vigorous leadership, counts on taking the upper hand over Mahmoud Abbas' aging team. And experts also claim that Mahmoud Abbas doesn't have a team capable of functioning in changing situation, and moreover, that he's losing popular support. But I really wonder whether that could lead to actual absorbing of Fatah by Hamas.
Hard to say, Gansi.
But I doubt that. I really doubt that scenario. Mm-hmm. But anyway, even Hamas assuming leading role in Palestine looks a grim perspective for Israel. But
as well as a grim perspective for the United Nations recognition of the independent Palestinian state, if led by Hamas.
True, but still, I think that's a little bit far-fetched speculation, because still now we have a combination of Fatah and Hamas. And Fatah has not been absorbed by Hamas as yet.
No, you're quite right. It's premature to speculate on the future, because right now, I think that the process is, I'd say, decisive stage. Much depends on it. But as of today, it doesn't look very bright. No hurry.
But like we said, there is the good old money explanation.
As always.
Cynical and sinister. Right?
Agreed.
That's true, but let us come back to the Daily Star stories. And I've noticed that the author doesn't even mention the difference between Hamas and Fatah. And he's just closing the issue with rather pompous talk of unity of all Palestinians.
So that's the reason why he doesn't mention the difference.
Yeah, and as to crucial problem of Israel's position regarding this unity, let me quote the tail end of the story. For now, though only naive dreamers, delusional fools, and political miscreants.
What a style.
Would react to the Hamas-Fatah reconciliation by asking what it means for peace with Israel, or demanding that Hamas recognize Israel before anything else happens.
You know what? I'm not afraid of posting myself as a fool. No, I suggest we could talk to Gershon Baskin, who is founder and CEO at Israel and Palestine Center for Research and Information. Mr. Baskin, thank you very much for joining us.
Do you think that it is a step towards better, more efficient peace negotiations, or perhaps on the contrary?
I don't see any peace negotiations taking place now or in the immediate future between Israel and the Palestinians. And I don't think that the reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas is influencing the fact that there is no negotiation process. The reason why there are no negotiations right now is because the government of Israel, led by Benjamin Netanyahu, is not prepared to discuss any kind of real peace with the Palestinians that the Palestinians can accept. The gaps are so wide between the sides, and the government of Israel is not willing to go back to where negotiations led to in the past. In other words, the Netanyahu government wants to start as if nothing happened over the last 18 years, and to begin negotiations, say, with an offer of 50 or 60% in the West Bank. And this is a non-starter for the Palestinians. So the Palestinians, I guess, thinking is that rather than doing something with Israel, which is impossible, let's at least make a peace in our own house.
But you personally, as an expert, do you see it as a positive development, or?
It's very mixed. The main challenge is the moderate camp amongst the Palestinians, the PLO leadership under Fatah, to bring about a moderation of the Hamas position. We've seen a gradual moderation of the Hamas position. Khaled Mashal and other leaders of Hamas are now talking about a Palestinian state in the 67 borders and not a Palestinian state in all of Palestine. They're not yet to the point where they're willing to recognize Israel or talk about peace with Israel, although Khaled Mashal allegedly said this week also that a peace could be talked about after there's a Palestinian state established. So this process is aimed at making them more moderate. And if that's successful, that's great. The thing is that if it doesn't happen, if Hamas refuses to accept any kind of the quartet conditions of recognizing Israel and renouncing terrorism, it could end up creating a very big financial crisis for the Palestinians if the Americans cut off their aid, if some European countries cut off the aid, if the Israelis don't transfer the tax payments. There could be an economic crisis in the West Bank and Gaza, which could very easily lead to a security crisis. Breakdown in security again, we're all in trouble.
And what was the reaction of the so-called Arab Street to the news?
Well, the Arab Street very much wanted this reconciliation to happen. The whole reconciliation program was leveraged by the government of Egypt, the interim military government of Egypt, who, in knowing that Hamas wanted to have access to an office in Cairo and wanted the border between Gaza and Egypt opened, the Egyptians used the leverage that they had and basically made Hamas sign the document which Fatah had signed already in October of 2009. So what happened is that Abu Mazen, President Abbas, and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank were completely taken by surprise. They did not expect this to happen. When it happened, it was a fait accompli. They had to deal with it and make do with it. But the Arab street and the Palestinian street in particular was very supportive of the unity. It was very uncomfortable for them to have a divided national authority.
And was the process somewhat perhaps stimulated by the Arab Spring developments?
Well, the Arab Spring development has not yet really crossed into the West Bank and Gaza. There were some Palestinian youths who started something which they called the March 15th movement, in which they called for unity. But it was a small demonstration in Ramallah and a smaller one in Bethlehem, and it didn't really take hold in the Palestinian street. But there's no doubt that President Abbas felt the pulse of the people and the desire for unity, and the call for unity of these youth definitely had an impact.
And as far as I know, the developments in Syria have somewhat alienated Hamas leadership from the Syrian leadership. Is that correct?
I think that the Hamas leadership is probably considering its options with the possibility of understanding that they may lose their home base in Syria in the coming future. There was a rumor, I don't know if it's true or not, that Khalid Mashal, the Hamas leader in Damascus, had actually sent a message to the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria encouraging them to continue with the uprising against the Assad regime. If this is true, then, and if I heard it, then for sure the Assad regime heard it, and they would not be very happy with that coming from Hamas.
But what are the relations between Hamas and the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, those relationships are quite good, and there's a lot of cooperation, and there will be increased cooperation between them. The rumor is that if Hamas has to leave Syria, they won't go to Egypt. The Egyptian regime doesn't want them in Egypt, but they would find a new base probably in Qatar, in Doha.
It's all very interesting, but it really, from what you are telling me, I got an impression that the so-called peace process is actually coming to a stalemate, despite all the developments.
It isn't a stalemate, and that's why the Palestinians are planning to bring the issue to the United Nations in September. Bring it back. The two-state solution was born in November of 1947 in the United Nations, when the United Nations was a new organization. And 64 years later, the Palestinians want to come back to the United Nations and say, save the two-state solution by recognizing the state of Palestine in the June 1967 borders, make Palestine a member state of the United Nations, and deal with the fact that the state of Israel is occupying another member state of the United Nations.
Well, that sounds like a big problem for the United Nations, because as far as I understand, this idea is supported by a growing number of countries, including those in Latin America.
Yeah, there's apparently about 130 countries which support the Palestinian plan now. The question is, of course, what will the United States do? What will Russia do? What will China do? What I suggested to the quartet, that I think that the Israeli-American position that imposed solution won't work is correct. With that, the European-Palestinian position that there has to be some kind of parameters so it's not an open negotiation forever is also correct. So the middle ground between the European position led by Britain, France, and Germany of putting down a proposal for parameters for a solution and the American proposal for negotiations is for the quartet to adopt what I call parameters for negotiations. In other words, they should frame the negotiations in a way that give it a time schedule, define the issues in such a way that the field is narrowed, that what they're negotiating on is more defined. The international community through the quartet has to also define what it is willing to give to support the process. process in terms of international peacekeeping troops, in terms of a willingness to provide security guarantees for Israel and guarantees for the Palestinians that there will, in fact, be Israeli withdrawals from the territory. These kind of parameters, in fact, I drafted a paper with 26 points on it, which I called the parameters for peace negotiations. And then if these were issued by the quartet should give a period of time, 6 months, say, for the parties to negotiate intensively with the assistance of the international community, the United States, the Europeans, whoever is willing to help, and then decided 6 months that they'll bring the agreement to the United Nations for passing a resolution in the Security Council.
You are listening to the Voice of Russia, one of the oldest radio stations in the world.
And now we are moving on to Redline's last heading, Man in the News. This week it is going to be Mr. Ivo Sanader, former Prime Minister of Croatia in 2003-2009, currently held in Austria, awaiting extradition to his homeland where he is charged with corruption. The authorities of Austria have already decided to extradite Mr. Sanader, and President of the Salzburg Provincial Court approved the decision despite claims by Sanader's lawyer that the former Prime Minister would not receive a fair trial in Croatia. So, Mira, back to the old dirty money question.
Well, indeed.
So, look, everyone in Croatia can expect to receive a fair trial, including former PM Ivo Sanader. Croatian President Ivo Josipovic said, rather predictably, by the way, commenting on the court's decision. However, Sanader said he would prefer to be tried in Austria, according to media reports, which is predictable too.
Absolutely.
So, Ivo Sanader, just a glimpse back, was arrested in Austria on the 10th of December 2010 on a Croatian warrant linking him to alleged corruption, embezzlement, and abuse of office. And now Austria also launched a separate investigation into Sanader's affairs on suspicion of money laundering.
So this is the scandal that suddenly pushed Mr. Sanader's name into headlines. And just think about it. Croatian leaders are rather infrequently noticed by world media these days.
And when they are in the headlines, usually it has to do either with criminal tribunal on former Yugoslavia in The Hague or some other fallout of the really savage civil war that resulted in disintegration of Yugoslavia. And in general, it seems that the memories of the war are still rather vivid in all parts of the former Yugoslavia.
Well, and there are some other bitter memories. I've seen the recent opinion polls that the majority of Croatians are dissatisfied with what their country has achieved since it proclaimed independence from the former Yugoslavia.
Yes,
just
indeed.
That 2 decades ago.
Well, but just to remind our listeners, Croatia proclaimed independence from Yugoslavia in June 1991 after a referendum in which more than 90% of citizens supported the move that sparked a 4 years war with ethnic Serbs, who were dead set against the independence of Croatia, obviously.
Well, this war, which claimed about 20,000 lives, and then the fraudulent privatizations in the 90s, clearly hurt Croatian economy rather seriously. And the global economic downturn also has hit it further, I would say.
The recent one,
of course. With Croatian economy shrinking steadily for the past 2 years, and just look, at present, the rate of unemployment stands at 8 years high of
20%. 20% is extremely
high unemployment.
High. That's an extremely high unemployment. It's almost twice as large as the largest total rate of unemployment in the European Union. Because when there's unemployment of 10%, we already start ringing bells of alarm.
Right? That's right. But when it is 20, it's too late to ring a bell because it's too late. It's too late to help the economy.
There's also the corruption issue, and the revelations of corruption are reaching the top levels in politics, including the former prime minister, also fuel public discontent.
But they do indeed.
I suggest we could now take a closer look at Ivo Sanader, at his career and at the charges set against him. So, he's 57 years old. He was educated in Austria, specialized in comparative literature, and he worked there as a publisher. Then he joined a nationalistic movement that later transformed into the Croatian Democratic Union, a CDZ, at present the leading center-right party of the country. So back in the year of 2000, he was elected leader of the CDZ, and in 2003, he won the election becoming the prime minister. And in 2007, I believe, he was re-elected.
Well, a straight and successful political career. Yet, in June 2009, Sanader abruptly resigned his post. No reasons given, no explanation made. Moreover, Sanader resigns from the CDZ too, naming Ms. Yadranka Kosor, his deputy both in government and in the party, as his possible successor.
Well, it's interesting, like you said, Sergei, so she's a poet and he's a writer. Anyway, Ms. Yadranka Kosor is 57 and she's the current prime minister of Croatia. She studied in Zagreb, where she graduated in law, by the way. So, but now she's a journalist and a poet too. She's the author of two poetry collections. So during the war, she worked as the BBC correspondent and later produced two books on war. And Ms. Kosor has a son.
As we already know, she replaced the Sanader both as prime minister and president of CDZ in 2009, right? Faced with a huge deficit, we just mentioned the economic situation of Croatia a while ago, but faced with this huge deficit and high unemployment, she had to introduce emergency budget. Aimed to reduce the spending and the national debt. It wasn't very popular. It never is popular with the
masses. I'm not sure whether it was successful.
She also started a massive anti-corruption campaign, and mind you, sparing no corrupt CDZ members. So a backlash was on the cards, and it followed, no doubt. Opposition accused the government, with special reference to Madam Prime Minister, of course, of concealing the facts of corruption in Sanader's time, insisting that his deputy, Yadranka Kosor, could not but be aware of them.
And Sanader chooses this moment to stage his comeback. This January, he announced he was returning to active politics, saying it was a mistake he ever left. And he accused Kosor and the members of the CDZ presidency of failed leadership. And most political pundits believed the reason of Sanader's surprise return was fear that he will eventually be tied with the numerous corruption scandals which have emerged since he left office. Anyway, Sanader was expelled from CDZ.
Okay, so Yadranka Kosor said his attempt to return to politics was a move to topple the government and create chaos at a decisive moment for the country's EU accession. So Croatia is expected to wrap up its accession negotiations under the current Hungarian EU presidency, is that correct?
Well, that is correct, but I want to take us back to Sanader, who is currently safely locked up in Austria. And the next news we are about to hear about him would come from a courtroom, right?
Well, we don't know.
Well, what else? I mean, they won't let him go without the trial, no. Meanwhile, Croatia is taken by a mounting popular unrest. It would have been naive, of course, to expect that Yadranka Kosor had harsh economic measures, including the war on corruption and the new labor legislation, strongly opposed by the trade unions, could really stop the economic downslide. So it was there. It is there.
Mira, do you mean the recent anti-government demonstrations in Zagreb and other cities?
Exactly. I'm referring
to this. Well, what a bitter irony. The crowds demanded Yadranka Kosor's resignation. As reported by France 24 TV, they also burned the European Union flag along with flags of the main opposition Socialist Party and CDZ. And I have noticed a familiar telltale feature. Predominance of young faces in the demonstrations that reportedly have been organized through Facebook.
Well, and with this, we end this edition of Red Line, brought to you by the Voice of Russia radio station. It was presented by its founders, Sergei Strokin and Mira Salganik, and me, Yekaterina Kudashkina. So thank you very much for staying with us. Goodbye and take care.
Take care and goodbye.
So long.
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 And goodbye.
So long.